Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and Margie Osman makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute discussing the issue of the retail industry. She's well known to many of you, so I will introduce her briefly. She's worked as a ministerial staffer, as the CEO of the State Chamber of Commerce, and currently the Chief Executive of the Australian National Retailers Association. She's also Chairman of the TAFE Commission here in New South Wales. She's on the board of the Australian Sports Commission, and she's Chair of the Retail Advisory Panel to the City of Sydney. And Margie Osman's going to talk to us tonight on retail and its competitive future. Many thanks.
Thank you very much, Jared. I'm going to sort of not worry too much about the microphone and potentially move around a bit. Can everybody hear me at the back of the room? Is that fine?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for your kind welcome this evening, and I'd have to be honest and say that representing large retailers doesn't also always guarantee me a kind welcome, so I'm doubly grateful. Can I say, I note that you were asked to turn your phones off, and that is customary at the beginning of one of these speeches, but I would have to say, please feel free to turn them back on again, because as far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't like you to miss out any opportunity to have a bit of a shop. So please have those phones or gadgets switched on. I shall be perfectly relaxed. Now, I seem to remember I had an opportunity to address you all here at the Institute in 2010, and we were fresh from the global financial crisis and feeling the benefit of some government handouts, always happily received, that were designed to stimulate the wider economy. But even then, it was clear that tough times were ahead. However, only the most pessimistic of commentators would have expected the number of retail failures we have seen and the now clearly permanent change in the Australian consumer. I think it is fair to say that saving is in fact the new black and not showing any signs of a style change in the near or medium future. And on the subject of major change, I am sure if you had suggested to perhaps the founders of Woolworths or Coles that water would be one of the biggest sellers in the future, back in 1922, I think it was, when Woolies was founded, you would have been laughed out of the store. So clearly from a retail point of view, change is what we're used to and change is what we're good at. But certainly I would have to say we've never seen it on quite the level we are now. Great retailers are all about flexibility, embracing that change and recognising trends. And critically, when I hear so often in the media and the social media world about how out of date our retailers are, I am constantly amazed. Icon brands like Woolies and Coles and DJs and Myers are facing a world of change with consumers very much in the driving seat. But their longevity as businesses is a product of their complete focus on the customer, and that is why we will still be shopping with them when 2050 rolls around. In the words of Grant O'Brien, I don't want you to think I'm completely fixated on Woolworths, but as Natalie is here tonight, as luck would have it, as Grant O'Brien himself from Woolworths has said, a new shopping revolution is occurring all around us, and it is tremendously exciting. Tonight I want to take you on a bit of a journey into that potential future with the caveat that all such crystal balling is of course speculation, and unlike a number of high profile federal government regulators and politicians, I am not certain what the future holds for retail. I'm prepared to take a stab, but I'm not as certain as some of them appear to be. So I just want to touch on some of the issues that are going to materially affect the future success of our sector and one of the biggest employers in the country. So, to ensure that we're all on the same page, let's start this journey with some vital measurements that are at least agreed and consistent. The Australian retail sector is one of the drivers of the Australian economy and is the key indicator of the nation's economic performance. It is the one part of the economy that is constantly, every day, every minute, connected to the Australian community. Somebody is nearly always shopping. The sector accounts for 5% of the national economy, a share of total industry value added twice that of agriculture, forestry and fishing, despite the relatively high level of publicity all of those things get. The retail sector is Australia's largest employer, with 11% of Australia's workforce employed in retail. That's 1.2 million people. And if you actually bump that up to the number of jobs that are affected by retail, there's another 500,000 Australians who owe their livelihood to the retail sector. It's especially important as an employer of young people and women, particularly those seeking part-time work. About half of all employees aged 15 to 19 and one in five employees aged 20 to 24 work in retail. And that proportion gets higher and higher the further west you go, at least on the eastern seaboard. If it was not for retail, there would be virtually no jobs for young people in regional communities. So whenever you hear this stuff about, oh, we don't need bricks and mortar, have another think about the structural impact of not having particularly the large supermarkets in those environments. It's the second largest employer of women. 690,000 women work in the sector, and more than 424,000 of those are working part-time and accommodating their families while they work. By a huge margin, food retailing is the single largest segment of the sector. In 2011, retail sales were $240 billion, distributed between food retailing at something just over $100 billion, department stores, clothing, household goods at something like $43 billion, hospitality and services about $32 billion, and other retailing about $35 billion. Within the food retailing segment, supermarkets and grocery stores account for a fairly big proportion of sales, and I include all variations of the grocery store in that. It's something just over $80 billion. So retail figures over the last 12 months, how are we actually sitting in the marketplace at the moment? Well, I think it's been a case of sort of up, down and shake it all around for the retail sector of late, with a dive in July that had some fairly nasty proportion to it, and then a slight uptick in the August retail figures of about 0.2% in August. The latest interest rate cuts may help. We're certainly pathetically grateful that the RBA decided to pull those rate cuts forward and not leave them until November, December, as they did last year. But the other question we have to ask is whether our radically changed and highly conservative consumer is at all impressed by 25 basis points. And I think on the basis of what we've seen up to now, the answer would have to be probably no. It takes 50 basis points to get them shifted at all. So we'll certainly be looking for another Christmas present from the RBA on Melbourne Cup Day, which is when the next interest rate announcement is. So sentiment figures, you may or may not have noticed, were released today. Sadly, I think one of the things about sentiment figures is that they're no longer really a very good reflection of people's willingness to spend. Confidence used to tell you everything you needed to know before. Now it's a less worthwhile measure, but for the sake of discussion, it was up a little bit today, and we're always happy to see at least some increase. It was an uptick of about 1% this month. But given the fact that the survey period covered partly the period where we got an interest rate cut, it should have been much better. I think retailers will take some comfort from it, but it's certainly not enough to get us tap dancing out there in the streets. There are some strong signals out of the sentiment piece that people may be ready for buying major household items. And I don't know whether I mentioned this last time, but I have this thing called the sofa index, which plays in over this period. Now, if you are prepared to make a major household purchase, if it's a fridge, you absolutely need it and you'll probably go ahead and buy it. If it's a sofa, you're inclined to say, oh, I can live with that for another year, I'll just get fresh cushions. So if people buy sofas, I have a feeling that we're starting to see the first sniff of a recovery. So watch this space on the soft home furnishings front. It'll be the giveaway. As I say, in recent times, that correlation between confidence and actual spending has not been all that strong. But 75 days out from Christmas, and I'm sure you're thrilled to hear that it's only 75 days to Christmas. Actually, can I have a show of hands? Who started their Christmas shopping? Oh, bless you. Should be more of it. Okay, so in this very challenging landscape, what is keeping retailers awake at night? Well, I'd probably boil it down to two issues. Now, this is my opinion, and I would boil it down to two clear issues. They would be competition policy and the willingness of regulators and politicians to take aim at the biggest target, which in that space is always going to be the large supermarkets. The other issue, I think, is the rush of change that technology is bringing and the lack of political will or understanding of what this means for public policy. The most pressing issue in this space is how governments will deal with the uneven playing field created by their failure to collect GST on overseas online purchases. Having said it's two issues, there is one issue, I suppose, which overrides all, and that is the Australian consumer and the manifest change in the way they think, the way they shop, and how much they are prepared to spend. And that is not going to change anytime soon. The cautious consumer is a reality for us all now. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about competition, one of my favourite topics. So, if in your business you were criticised for lowering prices for consumers and then in the same breath criticised for not paying growers and manufacturers more, if you were threatened with constant reviews of your behaviour and each time they were held, it showed that there was a highly competitive marketplace, if you had the responsibility for mums and dads shareholders to make a profit and grow but were constantly threatened with new impediments to that growth, if you had the responsibility in your business to hundreds of thousands of Australians who you employ and you therefore need to keep the business strong to keep their jobs in place, well, I would be happily welcoming you as a supermarket member of the Australian National Retailers Association, because that's what their life is all about. The knee-jerk grandstanding around the issue of competition in retail, and particularly in the supermarket space, is an area of constant concern and should be for everyone. So let's be really clear. Consumers win with an open and competitive market, no argument. Regulations and market restrictions boost vested interests and they prevent new market entrants and harm consumers. They harm the outcomes for consumers. However, in the supermarket world, the recent price war between the two major players, Coles and Woolworths, shows that politicians and potentially even the head of the ACCC would disagree with that contention. Price competition has inspired at least three parliamentary inquiries into food production and retail law. Most importantly, it has underlined how the media and many within the political system have an inbuilt and largely unquestioned bias in favour of the interests of producers over consumers. And let's be clear once again, this is about prices for consumers. Over the 116 submissions to the 2011 inquiry into the impacts of supermarket price decisions on the dairy industry, only three were supportive of cheaper consumer prices for milk. The rest were a mixed representation of producer interests at the expense of consumers. So we need to put the first myth about competition to rest. Despite the comments of everyone from media shock jocks to the head of the ACCC, the fact is we have a highly competitive supermarket sector. Yes, we do have two major supermarket chains, but both face increasing competition on price from international competitors like Aldi and Costco, as well as from IGA stores, who are now actively seeking to be price competitive in this space. And I have to say, all of those three are showing significant growth profiles. Despite the reality, there is an emerging enthusiasm amongst politicians and regulators to consider regulating the supermarket sector in favour of an ideal competitive marketplace, whatever that is. One of the most worrying developments in this space is the increasing noise that we hear in relation to a little thing called divestiture. Now, divestiture basically is an argument about putting a cap on the market share of some of the largest players, and it's effectively based on a piece of, in this case, American legislation. Recently, the Liberal National Party in Queensland at its state conference, and the Nationals most recently in the last month at their own federal conference, moved and accepted a motion in favour of divestiture, or the breaking up of companies perceived to be anti-competitive and misusing their market power. Now, on the surface, you might say that sounds like an awfully good idea, but if you were to experiment with that and unpack it a little bit, and say that a market cap might be set at 25%, the potential job losses and store closures that accrue to that are terrifying. Let's just take a seat like New England. We know that there would be something between 500 and 600 jobs would be lost and four major stores would close. In that marketplace, who would buy those stores if they were in fact sold? the most likely option is an overseas buyer who will care little or nothing for the local communities or for local jobs, and the money will go straight back to their country of origin. So it's an argument that deserves unpacking whenever you hear it. To be fair, this motion, when it was raised in Canberra at the federal conference, was opposed by many National Party people at that conference as a barrier to jobs growth and potentially leading to that greater foreign ownership. And I think it has particular relevance in regional communities because they would feel the brunt of this kind of over-regulation. The fact is that what's being proposed is a legislative response based on a US divestiture model, which is all about a monopoly, which we actually don't have in the supermarket space here in Australia. Most of the case studies are from the US, and the legislation hasn't been particularly successful there. Commentary out of the US itself cautions, breaking up a company via the court system can often take so long that the issue of market dominance has shifted with new players entering the market and changes in technology or community interest. There have been some arguments in this space that have actually gone on for decades in the United States. I think it'd be fair to say the only people who are making good money out of this are the lawyers. Ultimately, a divestiture means the economy's... Heaven forfend, I've just realised we're at Coors Whitaker Chambers, fabulous law firm, who would, of course, never engage in anything of the kind. Ultimately, a divestiture means that economies and efficiencies of a large company are lost and consumers bear the brunt of those higher costs. Divestiture can also mean significant financial impacts on small investors in those companies. We would argue that the support for the divestiture model is just hugely misguided, and that since the 2008 grocery inquiry, competition has dramatically increased, and the inquiry itself made a very clear point in terms of a workably competitive marketplace. And the point has actually been recently emphasised yet again as part of the federal government's national food plan, which stated, and I'm going to allow myself a little bureaucratic quote here, so please bear with me. The retail grocery market has continued to evolve since the ACCC's grocery report. Aldi has continued to expand and Costco has entered in three jurisdictions. These businesses have the size and supply chains in place to provide substantial and differentiated choice to consumers in some parts of Australia. The view of the National Food Plan was supported by the Federal Treasury, no less, some of my favourite bureaucrats, who stated in their submission, international supermarket chains such as Aldi and Costco are also emerging as a new source of competition for the major supermarket chains in Australia. Further retail competition is likely to put more downward pressure on prices, foster innovation, and increase consumer choice. I never disagree with Treasury. Importantly, I would say again, the National Food Plan outlined that despite some stakeholder concerns, the government believes that so far there is insufficient evidence to support many of the misuse market power allegations against the supermarkets. I would have thought that's pretty conclusive. However, in June 2012, the head of the ACCC, Ms. Sims, argued that supermarkets were engaging in incremental acquisitions of small outlets and that this raised significant competition concerns. Nevertheless, while openly criticising the behaviour of supermarkets in his speech in June, in that very same speech, he noted that the growth by the major supermarket chains has brought benefits to consumers as a result of their scale. All a bit confusing, but I think the bottom line is that we have a competitive marketplace and it's going to get more so. You could, however, be forgiven for thinking, if you were Coles and Woolies, that despite their contribution to the economy, jobs and communities, they are damned if they do and damned if they don't on most fronts. So, some food for thought in the competition space, and I hope next time you see coverage of this, you'll roll it down the line and think about those jobs and communities that owe such a great deal to some very big, iconic Australian companies. The next challenge is this technology thing. What the heck does this mean? And I'm loving this. This is a lady over here on the iPad. Exactly my point. So there's a great deal of discussion at the moment on the change technology is bringing to retail and the approach other countries have to the issues that it generates and how they deal with being part of a global economy. I think concerns around the failure to collect GST on items and services bought online from overseas has caused some fairly hot and heady emotional commentary over the last several years. Importantly, whatever anybody says, there can be no denying that the growth in this part of the retail activity sector is huge. It's growing at an enormous rate. Now, even the Productivity Commission, in its discussion about it, suggested that, oh, gosh, somewhere in the next 5 years we might get to as much as between 15 and 19% growth in sales online. Yes, well, in the figures that NAB has released in the last month or so, we're already showing 22% growth. It's rattling along at an alarming pace. And if you actually take it out of the whole of industry and put it into discretionary spend, which is the nice to have, it's the frocks and the books and the small electronics, it's the things that we can live without but would prefer not to, the impact becomes even stronger and more aggressive. Now, the government has actually stimulated two reviews, the federal government, that has looked at this issue in smaller and larger degrees. So to give a little bit of background, in 2011, the Productivity Commission conducted a broad-ranging inquiry into the retail sector. And I have to say, with our 100% support, I talk pretty regularly to our peers in places like London and New York. In their countries, nobody's bothered to do a Productivity Commission review of the retail sector. So in that sense, we are blessed and happy to have had it. And our colleagues overseas are, in fact, quite jealous of the emphasis that it brought. One of the recommendations of the Productivity Commission was there are strong in-principle grounds for the low-value threshold, which I'll come back and explain in a minute, exemption for GST and duty on imported goods to be lowered significantly to promote tax neutrality with domestic sales, all of which basically means they think the threshold should be lowered, they're just not quite certain how to do it. To give you a snapshot of what the threshold's about, at the moment, if you purchase something online from overseas and it's worth less than $1,000, you pay no GST on it. It comes into the country whole as bolus. Now, if it's worth more than $1,000, the likelihood is you probably haven't paid GST on it either, because the government is aware and tracking something like $58 million in fraud of people misrepresenting the value of the purchase that they're bringing into the country, with the active engagement of the supplier of the good in the first place, mainly in Hong Kong. Nevertheless, the Productivity Commission also recognised that based on current logistics and customs systems and the current level of consumer goods coming into Australia from overseas websites, that a complete removal of the LVT exemption for GST would result in a very high cost for, in fact, collecting the tax. And their argument became, well, it will cost us more to collect this tax than we will make from this tax, which I think you'd all agree is not a winning set of circumstances for any government to therefore consider it. The Productivity Commission also noted that in many other jurisdictions like the UK and Europe and Singapore and New Zealand and Canada and the US and Japan, they all have systems where there is a low value threshold that is significantly lower than $1,000, which is what it is here. In the UK it's £15 and in Canada it's $20. Both these countries are unashamed in their attitude to protection for local businesses, and that's exactly why the thresholds were set the way they were. In fact, in the UK, if you bring in a package from overseas and it's worth more than £15, you will also pay a handling fee to the Royal Mail for delivering it to you, as well as the VAT. So it's quite a sizeable impact. So one of the things that also came out of the Productivity Commission, beyond those two recommendations, was a recommendation to have another look at this, to have a closer look at the low-value threshold. So this investigation, which was conducted by the fabulously and glamorously named Low-Value Parcel Processing Task Force, and you can tell I've said that a few times, can't you? They found, the LVPPT, found that the systems upgrades needed to actually facilitate lowering that threshold were largely about the international postal system, but would only cost about $143 million, with a fairly low ongoing cost, which is about a tenth of what the Productivity Commission had suggested was going to be the cost. So lo and behold, the second report has effectively debunked and killed the elephant in the room, which is it will cost you more to collect than you will make out of the tax. Happy days, said we. If only the answer was to be that simple. Using the threshold, and let me give you an impression about why this is important, because if you pay GST on something, which if you buy iTunes now you do anyway, And if you are Amazon in any other part of the world, Amazon software, when you buy something from Amazon, recognises the country in the world that you're buying from, obviously. It also recognises whether or not it's registered to pay tax in that country. And it simply taxes you, in the same way that iTunes does. Not exactly a hard thing to accomplish, and certainly for a lot of these big online retailers, it exists within their current technology to be able to do it. So, the Productivity Commission estimated that if there was no threshold, you would probably collect something like $480 million, close enough to $500 million in GST on goods alone. We know that if you actually include services in that mechanism, so downloads of music and books and goodness knows what else, the figure comes up to about $1.6 billion. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd certainly like that money to be flowing into state treasuries to be looking at things like schools and hospitals and roads. That seems to me not a bad thing. Another issue from the Productivity Commission's lexicon of things was that this would be very hard from an infrastructure point of view to put in place. The LVPPT made it clear that they didn't actually believe that that was the case. There was some work that needed to be done, but probably it was the sort of thing that could be dealt with in around about 12 months. So basically, on publicly available data, we at ANRA estimate that the loss of revenue to states, as I say, is around about $1.5, $1.6 billion by the time you include downloads, and it will grow significantly. You've only got to look at the growth rates within the sector to know that that's the case. So this would appear to be a way of growing the GST base that is all about fairness and a level playing field here for Australian companies that employ an awful lot of Australians. The entry of state treasurers into this debate is, of course, extremely welcome from our point of view, and it emphasises the fact that any of that revenue that's raised will in fact be going towards roads, schools, hospitals, communities across the whole country. So as the debate goes on in this space, retailers of all sizes are feeling the pinch, and I fear that we will see even more closures and more jobs lost potentially, particularly in the discretionary spend space, while regulators and commentators literally fiddle while Rome burns. And we're rolling into yet another Christmas with no resolution to this issue, and Christmas, as you would all be aware, is the biggest spend time of the year. We're yet to see from the federal government a response to the latest report. I will say, though, that Minister Bradbury has been very transparent about the report and has certainly made it public as quickly as he possibly could. So we will now have to wait and see what appetite the government has to pursue this. But the bottom line is that overseas online is growing, and as it grows, it will become even more of an issue and a complex issue to deal with. Nobody in their right mind is suggesting that it's the sole problem facing the discretionary spend sector in retail, but it is part of a very difficult landscape that they're currently playing in and must be dealt with. Now, in the coming election, it would be impossible for me to avoid a discussion about the election. Retail and its relationship with households will be very much in the spotlight, and the debate on the issues that I've raised here today, I'm sure, will continue to keep me on early morning TV. And for those who know me, I'm not an early morning girl. I'm always pleased to do sunrise. The lack of a digital mindset in the government sector is an ongoing problem. And understanding the impact of new technology and what it will have, the impact it will have on the sector, can't be underestimated. Governments seem forced into a mindset that's all about analogue, not digital. Let me give you a couple of examples. One of the fastest growing areas for retail is a thing called click and pick, which means that you sit in your living room, you buy it on the computer, and then you toodle straight down to whoever it is you've bought it from, pick it up from the loading dock or from some other venue. What are the implications in that for state planning authorities? What are the implications in that for police and security authorities when people may choose to be picking things up 24/7? And the accompanying bad guys who may very well see this as an opportunity. What does this mean for the design of shopping centres in future? Do we need so much parking? Do we need different access? Are there different traffic provisions? As the future goes on and we buy more online, are our roads and systems geared to cope with an ever-increasing number of small trucks, which will be part of the logistics chain, delivering all of those packages to more and more venues? So when we look at these issues, some of the ones that I think are most important in the technology space and its implications are the changing skill base. We're going to see more and more high-tech and service workers and opportunities within retail. It's going to be an increasingly complex and exciting place to work. And I think the large retailers, particularly the large supermarkets in this space, have done some highly innovative work in mapping where their future will take them in terms of those jobs and giving people within the system tremendous opportunities. Is it going to be all about being able to buy your groceries at the train station by running your mobile phone over a display of groceries and having them delivered by the time you get home from your train journey? And we're already seeing that being tested here, and it's certainly been operating for some time in places like Korea. Are you going to be going shopping and watching the fashion parades being live streamed from Paris and have the racks in your store while you're shopping explain to you the makeup and sizing of the garment that you're holding onto? And while you might think that sounds completely out of it, the latest Burberry store in London now has that as completely possible. When you touch the racks, if you've shopped there before, it recognises you. And it will tell you what you bought before. It will explain the good that you have in your hand. They have special plinths so you can pick up the handbag and put it on the plinth. It will tell you where it was made, what it's made out of, on a big glass screen in front of you, while you're still getting somebody with an iPad standing there providing you with one-to-one face-to-face service. Enticing and scary at the same time. Or is it about the ability to, in fact, do your Christmas shopping from your computer or during your break at lunchtime, organising for it to be wrapped and having it waiting for you at the end of your journey in Perth when you go home for Christmas? So it's not even a case of you picking it up here. It's waiting for you at a special depot at the airport at the other end. Is it actually the fact that at some point in the not too far distant future you'll be able to buy fresh groceries from a store that's in the bottom of a building, certainly, but above it will be a vertical farm with groceries, fresh groceries grown on floors in a skyscraper above you? This is already being trialled in the UK, and they're having considerable success with it from a co-op farming point of view. Is it actually going to be the ability for you to send an avatar shopping instead of yourself? You'll now have your own personal avatar that'll whip into the store and try on those goods in your size and send you back the pictures to see whether you like them or not. There are stores that are already experimenting once again with this recognition factor, that when you work in the store, it recognises your mobile phone, it knows what you bought previously, what colours you prefer, what size you are, and it actually creates a holographic fashion parade for you as you come in store. So you can literally say, I'll try that one, and that one, and it's waiting for you in the changing room. One of the sadnesses about this change in technology, unfortunately, is the likely disappearance, however, of the checkout chick. The whole of cart scanner, which is going to acknowledge you and everything you have in your basket as you drive past it and bill your mobile phone, is not too very far away either. Although I'm sure in this new age of service being at the top of everybody's list, there'll still be somebody there to help you if that cart and scanner don't quite work out the way they should. So, the coming decade is going to be a very wild ride for all of us in the sector. And there is no doubt one key truth at the core of all of that, that consumers are now in the driving seat, and they and their mobile devices will be designing the future for all of us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Margie. So we come to question and discussion time, and I'd like to say thanks to Coors Chambers Westgarth for providing this facility this evening, and we've got till no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got time. You, as you know, represent the major retailers in the country, and of course there, as you know, there are others. They tend to complain about government regulation in relation to employing staff, penalty rates, that kind of thing. You're complaining about some bigger areas. But just tell us about your attitude to regulation, because you're objecting to some kind of regulation whereby the extent of your spread in an area that the large retailers could be restricted through disinvestment or divestiture or whatever. But on the other hand, when it comes to shopping online, you want to bring about a degree of regulation so that we prevent a build-up of small delivery trucks on the road, which are going to clamp up the road. So on the one hand, you don't want any regulation, but on the other hand, you seem to want some regulation. So is that too simplistic, or where do you stand?
I think there's probably a little bit of clarification.
You come back,
I think I'm a microphone.
No, you've got a camera there.
Perhaps if I just give you a snapshot of the association territory in this space, because as has been rightly pointed out, there are a few of us, and I would have to say with a woeful lack of imagination in our names. There is an organisation called the Australian Retailers Association, which is the oldest member of the family. There is an organisation called the National Retailers Association, which is in fact the ARA based in Queensland, but as Queenslanders are wont to do, they decided to secede and set up their own group called the National Retailers Association in Queensland. And then overarching these is the Australian National Retailers Association, which is us. Now, where did we come from? The other two entities that I mentioned are largely about small and medium-sized operators. They're largely training organisations, and they provide a whole range of worthy services, mainly into the small retail sector. ANRA was actually set up by Roger Corbett and John Fletcher when he was still at Myer, specifically because there was a perceived need to have a community of interest for these larger employers, and in fact to be about policy, to try and get ahead of the crashing wave. Where is the future taking this really important sector, and how do we influence government policy beyond simply the day-to-day? I mean, look, some of the most critical things we do are about point of origin labelling for particular grocery products. And that's a really important thing. A lot of the work we do is in trading hours, another really important thing. But overarching those have to be much bigger issues that are about the philosophy of government and where we want the economy in the country to go. And I suppose that's why I've dealt with those two particularly large pieces of the puzzle today. I would take issue with one thing you said. I'm not against more trucks being out there delivering packages, and I'm certainly not against online of any kind. Basically, that kind of digital shop is going to be part and parcel of the future. You're not going to be able to be a retailer in future unless you're smart enough to be activated in all of those spaces. The future is about innovation. Innovate or die. That's all there is to it. Now, from the point of view of what is the combination of those two parts of the puzzle, you've only got to look at people like Topshop and Zara, who have, of course, come here and established bricks and mortar presence because they know it drives action online. The big guys will tell you they can read from their loyalty schemes that a combination of both options is what customers and consumers want, and the future will be about all of those issues. No retailer who is going to be here in 2 years' time, let alone 50 years' time, can afford to be one-eyed about this. You've got to have the whole marketplace. Now, in terms of the legislation I'm talking about here, the divestiture piece of the puzzle, while it's, I think, by my good friend, Mr. Barnaby Joyce, is wholly and solely directed at the large supermarkets, it has the danger of being applied to a whole range of other areas as well, and this is something we think the wider business community should be aware of. We also think there's been enough reviews done and enough understanding of competition law to know that there is plenty of grunt and muscle available to do what needs to be done right now. In terms of the online space, I'm unashamedly saying that this is about creating a level playing field for Australian companies who employ Australians and for money that stays here. I don't think I have to apologise for that. I think that that's just what it should be. And that's why we're saying that government needs to examine more closely this issue of what happens with the threshold. I'm all in favour of more small trucks out there, though, delivering lots of goods that you've hopefully bought from an Australian online retailer. And I would say to you that the biggest online retailers in the country at the moment are companies like Woolworths, Coles, JB Hi-Fi, Big W, which is one of the world's innovators in this space. Big W was one of the first to, in fact, design a specific app that allowed you to lay by and do all sorts of amazing stuff online, because that's what their shoppers want. And in case you didn't know, one of the reasons why this is such a big drama, particularly things like lay-by, I'm just going to digress for a moment of trivia, is that some of the biggest sales now are actually in the middle of the year, and they are Christmas sales, because smart parents go and buy toys and other goods for their kids in the middle of the year. So Big W has an enormous role to play in the middle of the year for those cost-conscious parents who buy in that environment and put it on lay-by. Once again, it's about responding to what consumers want. If you don't do that, you won't be here to have this conversation too far into the future.
Well, there's a question here, then one question here. Just stay here.
If the $1,000 GST thing was diminished, say
yes.
$100 or $50 or whatever it was. Does your association or your members think would be the change in retail spend within Australia?
Do you mean those dollars automatically revert to buying things here in Australia?
Yes. What level?
Look, it's difficult to speculate on exactly what the level would be. Let me put it to you this way, that with the threshold set at $1,000, customs would currently be processing something like 38,000, 39,000 packages. If it gets lowered down to $100, there'll be 16 million packages. Now, I think the issue here is not so much that it will necessarily radically diminish those numbers, but what it will do is create a more level playing field so that the pricing issues that affect local retailers will at least in some small way be addressed. As I said, nobody is suggesting for a moment that the GST is the whole and soul of that issue. It comes back to other forms of regulation, whether it be penalty rates, whether it be the rents people pay, whether it be power costs. A whole range of other issues contribute to price. But this one around the online packaging is an important one because it's just going to keep growing.
There's a question here.
Yes, I shop at Coles because it's nearest to my place, and I'm finding more and more brands disappearing. They're now under the Coles brand. In some cases, quite good products have disappeared because they were more expensive, and Coles is a lot cheaper, 10 cents, cheaper for a lot of things. And it seems to me, sooner or later, there won't be any brands except Coles, and then Coles can put the prices up. I'm just worried about the brands I like.
Yeah, look, I think, let me say this to you. I know I've said it a few times. Retail is now completely driven by what customers want. If customers want those brands will be available in store. That's all there is to it. Now, in the context of private label, which is often seen as a vexed issue, there's a very interesting piece of research that's done by IBM Consulting each year called the Smart Consumer, and they do it globally, and they have something like 16,000 individual respondents to this piece of work, and 2,500 of them are here in Australia. One of the things that they're now tracking is this attitude issue to private label. And I think it's also important to notice that private label within store has a whole lot of different levels to it. And those levels are designed to meet what customers have told the retailers they need and want from a quality and pricing perspective. But getting back to this IBM issue, what IBM are now tracking is the people are showing, from your point of view, but a genuine preference for a whole range of those private label issues because they're investing the trust that they see manifested in the big brands like Coles and Woolies. When they see that reflected on a private label, they feel good about that product and they want to buy it. So within the consumer mindset itself, there is, a much warmer attitude towards private label than people often give it credit for.
Right, so I'm just thinking, there's a question here, then we go down the back. Yep, yes. Behind.
Okay, yes. Ms. Osman, you've mentioned that the recent cut in the Reserve Bank interest rate, the sales remain subdued, and some have commented that the problem is not interest rates, the problem is that the slowdown in the circulation of money due to the carbon tax and the higher personal income tax rates. Given that, if there is another cut, do you actually foresee retailers continue to cut costs, merge, sell out, or even close in the near future?
Okay. I wouldn't put all of the woes of the industry wholly and solely at the doorstep of interest rates. But they do have an incredibly important role to play. But that role has changed with the change in the consumers. Once upon a time, 25 basis points, yoo-hoo, people were out there and their credit cards were white hot. You know, they were spending up a storm. Now it's a case of, 25 basis points, that's not enough to get me excited. And last year when the bank made those cuts in November and December, it was too late for the trickle-down effect, which is required for there to be a real impact on people's spending behaviour, to occur. Now, we've got it 1 month earlier this year, and we'll have to hope that that will have some effect for Christmas, but more likely it's going to have an effect for the post-Christmas sales, and that's a good thing in its own right. I do worry about what is going to happen this Christmas. I worry more about what's going to happen next Christmas if we don't see some change in government's attitude to things like overseas online, or we don't see a greater understanding of how things government does are impacting on this sector, which employs so many people. And if I could just say one other thing about the people it employs. One of the things that we know is for many people, they're getting to their late 50s, early 60s, and potentially finding themselves not in the situation where they can retire or potentially coming back into the workforce. And we're seeing this in a number of our retailers now. They are the place that is most likely to absorb those older Australians who are needing another zigzag career to, in fact, top up their superannuation. And companies like Bunnings, for example, have been incredibly intelligent about this. And one of the things that's a critical part of their service offering is that you're quite likely to go in there and find somebody, in the words of Rodgers and Hammerstein from The Sound of Music, older and wiser, who can give you the best possible advice on what you need and what you should be using. So I think there's some other interesting demographics. It's a bit like this issue of brain drain out of country towns if you shut down all the bricks and mortar retail that's existing in them. There are untold other impacts down the line.
So we've got to be quick now. So there's a question here, there's a question there, then we go down the back. Yep. No, we're here first.
My question is, as I walk around the retail shopping centres, see many small retailers with no apparent customers in them paying high rents, how long does it take for these startup companies to go broke, and what proportion of them do indeed go broke?
Well, sadly, the answer to that is at the moment not very long is the answer to how long it takes. I think if I can say this about smaller retailers, yes, it is an incredibly difficult and risky environment for them at the moment. But there are positives to being small also. For a number of small niche retailers, they're very fleet of foot. They can respond to consumer needs much more quickly in many instances because of the sort of short length of their process line, if you like, and the fact that they have very personal relationships. And so they're already, in many instances, absorbing that thing which we do know drives people to shop, and that is a desire for experience, an experience of some kind, which is why you've seen over the last several years that restaurants and cafes have still continued to do well, as have in many instances theatre companies and concert ticket providers and all those sorts of things, because people are happy to pay for an experience. So the small guys have that capacity sometimes in a much more fleet of foot way than the larger retailers. But having said that, increasingly from those of my association peers who have a large number of small businesses, it is increasingly difficult. And that is, I suppose, why I say I fear for what we may see out of this Christmas. The very laudable growth that we're seeing amongst, say, the food sector may actually be camouflaging a greater loss of jobs from the discretionary spend than is currently obvious.
There's a question here.
Australia is a pretty clever country, and we innovate reasonably well and come up with some great things. What successes are you seeing in terms of Australians being able to develop ideas that sell online overseas?
I think this is the big part of the puzzle that not enough people are paying attention to. There are an awful lot of Australian companies that are amazing innovators in this space, and many of them who are looking at this as the active platform that allows them to trade into Asia, which might not otherwise have been possible. So in an environment where we're spending an awful lot of time talking about the Asian century and what that means, I actually see the online mechanism, as it's embraced by more and more retailers, as providing that platform into Asia that might not otherwise have existed. And I think that's one of the great positives out of the exercise. And it's one of the really exciting parts of the exercise. I mean, I completely agree with you. Yeah.
We'll get in the back.
I think the burden, what you're saying, is that there is an elephant, a huge elephant in the retail room called online shopping. It must be affecting various parts of the retail spectrum differentially.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you could just describe what is the differential effect across the broad spectrum, and in particular about shopping malls. Are they the ones that are most in danger?
I don't know whether it's the geography of where your shop is placed that's the issue. If you actually look at what constitutes online shopping, the figures will say to you at the moment that it's probably across the board, sitting at about 5, maybe 6% if you push it out. And that online is a very small proportion of that it might be as little as 3%. But that's when you take it across the whole marketplace. When you actually bring that back into the discretionary spend area, which is frocks and hats and shoes and books and small electronics and DVDs and goodness knows what else, that proportion is dramatically increased and is probably closer to 20% is being represented by overseas online. And there's nothing wrong with people buying overseas online. There's a whole range of sort of range, brand, access, convenience issues that make it a very attractive thing to do. All we're saying is that if local retailers have to collect the GST, we think foreign retailers should have to too, because that's money that could be going back into your states to buy things that are important for your community.
I think you misunderstood me.
Oh, sorry.
I wasn't talking about overseas online.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm sorry.
I'm talking about local online.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Okay. I beg your pardon. Well, in that case, across the board, you would say that online shopping makes up about 5 to 6%, with overseas being a much smaller proportion of that. But nevertheless, even domestically, online has probably got a slight preponderance in terms of cut through with the discretionary spend guys. But in the same breath, I would say to you that an ever-increasing number of people are taking up the offer of the food retailers, whether they're Coles, Woolies, Aldi, Costco, whoever else, to be able to purchase online with a whole range of associated services. So that the issue that I mentioned to you earlier about being able to stand on the train station with your smartphone and just swipe a whole lot of barcoded objects and fill your shopping basket that's waiting for you when you get home, that's a reality of that kind of shopping as well. And I think I could stand to be corrected here, but I think actually Woolworths is now the biggest online shopping mechanism in the country.
Now we're good, we're in a bit of a hurry. So right down the back over here, yeah.
I'm a retired common shopkeeper, but I must say there. I buy this shirt that's bought in England, right? Now, when you say competition in Australia, that's where the competition is. Four quality cotton shirts delivered to your door in 7 days, £100 sterling. About a quarter of what you can buy here. Mm. I'll be the first to sign up to reduce the level for GST to $10. Because frankly, instead of being a quarter of the price, it might go to a third of the price. I'll still be happy. Now, that is the issue. I don't think you'll find that people are... And if they bring in the, if they bring in the GST, we will search harder to buy at an appropriate price.
And look, that's I don't disagree with you, and I think I said that it's not the whole answer, but it's certainly a part of the answer. There is everything from the need to roll forward clothing tariffs by 5 years within the framework that's already been set and do away with them. It's the issue of how much rents cost. It's the issue of all of the costs that are getting passed down the supply chain because of the carbon price. You know, the suppliers cheaply pass them down the line to retailers. It's the cost of delivering here in this country. It's a huge range of other issues and our industrial relations system that don't apply to those overseas retailers who can supply at those prices. And I understand where you're coming from. It's not the only part of the puzzle, but it's nevertheless an important one.
Now we've got to be quick, we're going near the end, so right down the back and then here. Yeah. Yes?
I've been involved in the internet business since 1995, and I've noticed, of course, the huge growth in the online shopping sites. And we, in our particular business, are trying to promote and help Australian shops, especially small businesses, local businesses. But I've noticed they are making a big mistake lately. Because they're so excited about going online and having an online service, they're forgetting that they've actually got a physical shop, and they don't put the address on the home page, and it's almost impossible to find out where they are located.
Yes, look, I think that plays to exactly the point that I made before, that the future has to be about the integration of online and bricks and mortar. You can't operate in isolation. Neither of them is going to be the answer wholly and solely in future. We're also wedded to our gadgets. It's going to be a case of the marriage made in heaven between all of those parts of the puzzle, with all of our gadgets acting as bridesmaids, I think.
So I think we're getting... So they've got the last two questions there, one and two. Yeah, OK. Oh, hang on. Well, yeah, I'll call to you first.
My question was based on the question before about Woolworths being one of the biggest of the online suppliers for food, and your scenario of the railway station. Well, what is that going to do to jobs in Woolworths? I mean, you're talking about all these people, and you're talking about how what a great place they are for supplying employment. What you're saying now is that they won't have jobs.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the jobs will change.
Yeah.
Many of those jobs are going to be in a different space. The future of retail is going to look dramatically different, and it's quite interesting that this is happening at a time when, for a number of years, retail's been having a conversation about what does it mean to have a career in retail. What kind of skill base do you need? What will the future look like? And what we do know is that the skill base is going to be different going forward. I think interestingly, and when I say there's always going to be a need for bricks and mortar and a need for the online, it is that service offering and the capacity to touch people that will always still be an important part of the mix. And once again, if you take something like Big W as an example, I mean, their future planning makes it clear that it will be as much about the services that you use when you're in store. It won't all be about the purchase. It'll be about the other things you're able to do in that environment. So certainly, at least on the projections that we're seeing at the moment, particularly within the food sector, this is not about a loss of jobs in that sector, and it's something that I know the CEOs in that space have been particularly concerned about. So it's an object of great focus. So if I can give you any comfort on that score, it's certainly not that we see jobs being shed. It's that they will change, particularly in the food sector. What we're concerned about at the moment is the disproportionate impact that this is having hugely on the discretionary spend before we actually get to the point where all of those new futures are part and parcel of the shopping experience.
So just a final question. What about, you spoke about the Asian century and all that. To what extent has Australia got an opportunity for people to come here to shop from increasingly wealthy societies to our north, both physically and online? Is that a realistic proposal or is that pie in the sky?
No, I think it's a fabulously realistic proposal, particularly in the tourism space. Chinese tourists are amongst the biggest shoppers the world has ever seen. The aspirational Chinese shopper is a very impressive holder of a credit card. Having spent some time on the board of Events New South Wales and the New South Wales Tourism Board, there's an enormous concentration on what happens with these Chinese shoppers. Now, I just want to tell you a very quick story. Most of them use a thing called the China User Pays Card, which is the generic credit card in China. They have everything put through it, their bills, their pay, everything. It's a government-sponsored card. Most stores here in Australia currently don't accept it. In London, Harrods made the decision 3 or 4 years ago that they would accept this credit card. The standing record for a single purchase by a single individual, I can only assume it must have been a number of handbags, not just one, was £160,000, I beg your pardon, in a single afternoon at Harrods on a user pays card. Now tell me why you wouldn't take that card here in Sydney. Part of the other problem is that if they can't use the card here, Chinese tourists have shown themselves most likely to carry very large sums of money in cash, which makes them, of course, you know, at risk while they're in our town, and that's not what we like either. So they are a fabulously important part of the retail tourism outcome going forward. So, yes, roll on the user pays China card. Absolutely.
Many thanks, Margie. I mean, some of us, I know there are more questions, but some of us have got to go out shopping, so we'll pick up the parcel on the way home. So I'll be very brief. I'll be very, very brief. Margie Osmond's a very articulate and forceful presenter of the view of the Australian National Retailers Association. She does it very well. We see her on television, we hear her on radio, and she's spoken here for this, the second occasion. But it just underlines the point of how important the retail industry is to all Australians as an employer of younger people and older people and those in between. It's a very important part of the Australian economy, and it's essential, I think, that we all know how it's faring and what might be done to take off some of the shackles on retail generally. And so it's significant you've come along tonight, filled us in. Maybe after Christmas the following year we'll bring you back and check you out. Many thanks.
No, you just beam me in. That's okay.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.